This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with A.G. Crow, former state lawmaker. He's one of a number of candidates running for Secretary of State. At the age of 70, A.G. Crow wants to succeed Tom Shedler, who resigned earlier this year. And he's joined by an array of other candidates, including the man who is now acting Secretary, Kyle Ardoin. We'll talk with A.G. Crow. Also, David Madden, the celebrated novelist, former writer-in-residence at LSU. Many books. He continues his prolific writing. And tomorrow, in North Carolina, where he now lives, he's moved from Park Boulevard in Baton Rouge to the hills of North Carolina. David Madden turns 85 years old. And Kate Davies is with us. Her book is Intrinsic Hope, Living Courageously in Troubled Times. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. If you're locally dialing, it's 297-5633, and you can reach us always at talklouisiana.org. Talk at talklouisiana.org. We're joined by A.G. Crow, the former state senator who is now embarking on a major quest to become the Secretary of State. He was first up for qualifying last week, and now we know who is in the field for the race November 6th to succeed Tom Shedler. It's A.G. Crow, joined by Rick Edmonds, who will be with us tomorrow, Renee Fontenot-Free, Thomas Kennedy, Matthew Morrow, Julie Stokes, Heather Cloud, Gwen Collins-Greenup, and Kyle Ardoin. And good morning to you, Senator Crow.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you this morning and your listeners.
Well, it is nice to hear your voice. A.G., as you can hear, is on the road. And at the age of 70, why have you decided to embark on this quest?
Well, first off, the age of 70 is the new norm for those that used to be 50. We're in great shape, great health, lots of energy, and with a lot of experience, we're coming to this office. In fact, my 16 years in the legislature and 16 years in the records management industry uniquely prepares me to serve as the Secretary of State. Working together, you know, with the many talented and hardworking people of the office now, and also to protect the integrity of the elections process and streamline business services and filings and offer, you know, innovative solutions to protect the identity of all Louisianians. I think there's some room for improvement there. I also regard serving the public as a privilege, and I'm eager to bring my fiscal conservative management style, you know, to the office.
Well, A.G. Crow is a man who knows Tom Shedler pretty well. You served in neighboring districts.
We sure did. As a matter of fact, Tom started off his political career there in Slidell as a councilman, and he's a businessman just as myself, and spent his additional time serving the public, and I think he did an outstanding job over the years.
What did you make of his demise?
Well, you know, I'm one to basically not look at others and see other flaws in other people. You know, I have my own flaws, and I'd rather not even go there, to be honest with you, Jim. I think Tom is a wonderful person, a very talented person. He served the public well. And I just like to focus on all the good things that he did. And just like that, I do with anybody that I talk about or the name comes up.
Were you surprised his successor, Kyle Ardoin, got into the race?
I think that some people were surprised. Of course, I'm encouraged more and more every day by the strong support I'm receiving from community leaders, elected officials, and people all over the state. We're on a third tour now in the last 14 days of the entire state, and we're not slowing down. I'm focused on no one's campaign but my own. I'm on the trail 7 days a week, sharing our message with every voter in the state and sharing with Louisianans why my record in the legislature and business prepares me so well to protect sensitive records, the integrity of elections, mm-hmm. and other things. I do, however, believe that trust is among the top reasons why voters should consider a candidate. And a candidate must be able to be trusted, or he shouldn't be elected. I would imagine Kyle will have to answer some questions regarding his change of heart in stating that he would not run for office publicly. And if he were chosen as the interim to then qualify to run, so regaining the trust of the voters is a hurdle that he'll have to leap. But, you know, we have a fine group of folks in the field running. They all have to be given credit for wanting to serve the public. And I will run my campaign based on Ephesians 4:29, which basically means we will have no disparaging of any of our opponents and simply uplift them even in prayer every day. So as I was mentioning, you know, I think I have the credentials to be able to run the office. I do have a clear understanding of what the office does and all the various departments. Coming from, you know, the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, we've come a long way. I've got a degree in business at Southeastern, where I've also served as an adjunct professor, and I've served as a member of the school board, 8 years in the House of Representatives, 8 years in the Senate, president of the Louisiana Deepwater International Port, which we're excited about making an announcement soon about exporting oil, Louisiana oil and gas. That will bring many, many jobs and economic opportunities for our state.
All right. Course, hold tight. Know, hold tight. Hold tight. 877-217-5757. A.G. Crow, born in New Orleans, as you heard, grew up in the Ninth Ward, now resides in Pearl River. Almon Gaston Crow, Jr. He is a 16-year veteran of the state legislature and a business person as well. You noted that you have been in business. I think in 1982, we're going back more than 35 years, you started a company, St. Tammany Office Products. What about your background in record keeping? Some people, of course, know this office is one that involves you being the, if you're elected, being the premier record keeper in the state. What about your ability to do that? Are you equipped to do it?
Well, not only am I equipped to do it, I've devised programs and technologies and techniques along with my partner who is a certified records manager and developed a business model that we expanded, started in Slidell, but we expanded it around the state of Louisiana and other states, franchising the company. And basically, it's addressing the fact that today we live in a world of technology where information is the new currency. And every day somebody wakes up trying to steal somebody's identity, which happens about every 3 seconds, by the way. And so our whole mission with the record storage industry, and it's an industry that's been around for about 40 years or so, 40 or 50 years, if not a little longer, all that is basically a concept where instead of keeping your records in a mini storage or somewhere where they can be exposed to someone else, which, by the way, has Social Security numbers, credit card numbers, information about your health, trade secrets, and all these other types of things that other people want to get their hands on. We simply bring in those same boxes in a controlled environment where nobody goes in. They're barcoded, they're tracked. There's a retention schedule, there's an expiration date, and it's a complete lifecycle management process for those records. It just so happens that's the same thing that the Secretary of State is charged to do, not just with state agencies, but every political subdivision in the state. And we know, my own personal experiences have shown me on a regular basis, that there are every courthouse in the state of Louisiana is packed full of records, and whether it's the sheriff's records or the city's records or the clerk of court or the register or the assessor. And basically, they're charged with making sure those records are kept confidential and not gotten into the wrong hands. We can actually expand the program for the Secretary of State, and we do have a detailed plan to do so.
All right, hold tight. 877-217-5757. We do have some people wishing to talk to Senator Crow, and if you're inclined to do so, we do have one line open. Again, 877-217-5757. Jim on I-12. Jim, good morning. You're on the air with Senator Crow.
Good morning, Senator Crow. You talked about the trustworthiness of your opponent, and yet you're in the state legislature and talking about being trustworthy.
He was in the state legislature.
You were.
Not anymore.
But he was in there rubber stamping Bobby Jindal's financial disaster for this state.
All right.
You know, I mean, I'm not certain what fiscal conservancy it involves just absolutely turning the state into a third world nation.
All right. What about the legacy of Bobby Jindal? You were there. Was it a good one?
Well, you know, there's two sides of every story, and certainly fiscal conservatism is something that we all strive for, and I think I may hold the record for the most number of no votes on taxes in my 16 years in the legislature. And when you're dealing with a certain situation, which I've always referred to as fiscal deficit disorder, given the fact that over the many 50 to 60 to 70 years, the constitutionally mandated spending has grown to where it's about 70%. No matter who the governor is, it's walking into a disaster, a financial disaster, because you don't have a whole lot to play with other than the areas not protected by the Constitution.
Well, in reality, though, Senator Crowe, this particular job does not involve handling the budget. You're handling a lot of important things, but not that.
That is correct, but I just wanted to make sure I addressed the question and as to why. And when you have a fiscal situation like we do in the state of Louisiana, quite honestly, it's broken. And it's been broken for many, many years. And every governor that comes in and all the legislative help that he needs or we work together to try to achieve is a very, very difficult thing to do because our hands are tied. And until we have some sort of understanding and action that's going to allow for the unconstitutionalizing of a lot of our spending, we're going to continue to have fiscal deficit disorder. So it is an uphill battle and a challenge for anybody in the governor's office.
Well, the Secretary of State's office, like others, has experienced some budget cuts. Are there more areas to cut, or are you going to try to hold on with what you have if you get the job?
Well, I'm certainly going to take a look closely and use our experiences as fiscal conservative management style. But I do think that there's also some areas of savings. For example, once we get into the office, there is a strong possibility that we can create some internal revenue streams, which I'm going to be developing in our detailed plan as we go through the campaign.
877-217-5757. A.G. Crowe, candidate for the Office of Secretary of State, deemed by some as the third highest office in the state. He's back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and our guest for a few more minutes is A.G. Crowe, candidate for Secretary of State, a 16-year veteran of the Louisiana legislature. He is now out of the legislature, having left in 2016, but he is seeking to come back into government at the age of 70, and he is perhaps the most experienced of the candidates running. Nine of them have signed up to succeed Tom Shedler. The election is the 6th of November. Again, if you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Senator Crowe, Tracy asks, will you be using this as a stepping stone, noting that Paul Hardy, who held the position, ran for governor, Jim Brown ran for governor, Fox McKithen ran for the U.S. Senate, and Jay Darden ran for lieutenant governor, all from the Secretary of State's post. Will you be doing this if you're elected?
Well, I can tell you straight up, I'm not seeking the office because I need a job. Number one, I'm retired. I do have a very successful company that provides very well for me. This is not a stepping stone for another political office. I simply want to serve the great state of Louisiana. It is a fair question. I think every candidate should be asked that. And I know what the job requires, and I have the experience to step right in without having to do any type of on-the-job training because of my many years in the private sector. The election really is about bringing experienced people to the office of the state, or Secretary of the State. And it's also about serving with transparency, with integrity, with fairness, with temperance, and most importantly, with honoring God in your daily walk. And I simply want to be a voice for good government, for spending tax dollars carefully, and for serving with honor every person in the state, regardless of what their party affiliation is.
Dan downtown. Hi, Dan. You're on the air with Senator Crowe.
Yes, Senator. Do you agree that part of the good work of former Secretary of State Shedler was his refusal to go along with Trump's effort upon first taking office to suppress the vote of those who might not have supported him?
Well, I don't recall that exact incident, but I will tell you this. I will stand up for the right for people to vote in any party, as long as it's legal. And obviously, they're following all the rules and regulations. I think we need to do whatever we need to do to make voting or to allow people to vote, make it that process as headache-free and as simple and easy as possible. I think Louisiana does have the highest rate of registered voters in the entire nation, which is, I think, 86%, if I'm not mistaken, of reading about that recently. And I think that's a good number. But I think that the problem we have is getting the voters to turn out. And that's been something that's just been horrible, not just in Louisiana, but all around the country. And so one of the things that we want to focus on, and one of the actual charges in this department, is increasing the voter turnout. And I actually have indicated, and I've always run my races in a way that's positive and always talked about what we brought to the table and not in any way disparage any of my opponents in any race that I've ever been in before. And I'm going to do the same thing on this race. And I think that mudslinging and disparaging opponents and this type of thing drives down the level of people voting. And I think that because we're over elections, this particular office, we, all of us in this race, should be, and I think that this, we can count on this. Hopefully we can.
Final question from Holly in the Garden District, Senator, about the integrity of the elections. It is apparent that Vladimir V. Putin of Russia tried to interfere with the U.S. election, may have even tried to get into voting machines. Electronic voting machines are considered particularly susceptible. Are you concerned about Vladimir Putin trying to get involved in a Louisiana election?
I'm concerned about anybody interfering with the election process, whether they're in this country or any other part of the world. And I do believe that right now, in fact, I know right now, the vote, the machines do not, we're not, the results of the voting is not exposed on the internet, which is a good thing. We also know that there are people out there every day trying techniques one way or the other, trying to, again, cyber bully or cyber attack the voting process. There are also situations that are happening inside of voting polls in various parts of the state. In fact, it wasn't that long ago, in the last couple of weeks, that at some part of the state, somebody was, investigated, and I believe indictments are coming for a voter fraud. And so these are things that we have to constantly stay on top of, constantly work with our legislators, which I've got experience doing for many, many years, so that the voter integrity process or the integrity of the voting process is held to its highest standards. That's something that's a daily challenge and that we have to stay ahead of, because people out there are always trying to hack in and trying to interfere with this process.
Well, thank you for joining us, A.G. Crow. I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk again, and I would think that any handicapper would say that you're one of the leading candidates to succeed Tom Shedler. Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me, and have a great day.
You too. And a reminder that tomorrow we'll be visiting with another candidate, Rick Edmonds, and hopefully we'll hear from all the candidates before November 6th. David Madden is with us. The noted novelist, born July 25th, 1933, which means tomorrow, this man who was born in Knoxville in 1933, right after Franklin Roosevelt took office, will be 85 years old. And for years, David Madden ruled Park Boulevard. He was the Bard of Park Boulevard, the writer in residence at LSU, and has a prolific record as a writer that continues. It started in 1961 with The Beautiful Greed. And it is always good to talk with you, David Madden, joining us from the mountains of North Carolina.
Well, hello, Jim.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always really great to reconnect with, well, you, first of all, and everybody who is possibly listening in Baton Rouge. Well, we had a great life there.
How many years were you here?
41.
About half of your life.
I intended to stay 10 years. I was influenced by reading All the King's Men and The Moviegoer, and I thought, well, I'd like to go back down there, and I visited and experienced the South for at least 10 years before the South disappears. When I got to Baton Rouge, I saw that it had already disappeared, and then, of course, New Orleans is a good safe harbor for many things Southern, but many things very cosmopolitan, too, of course.
You mentioned The Moviegoer and All the King's Men, and those words written by Robert Penn Warren and Walker Percy, they'll live long after you and I are gone, as will your words. But sometimes we neglect to appreciate their legacy. To my knowledge, there's no building named after Robert Penn Warren at LSU. There should be, though.
Oh, my God, yes. It's incredible, the things that don't happen at LSU. But I do want to say that Robert Penn Warren was a good friend of mine for a long time. I put on four or five different conferences about him while I was at LSU and published a book about him. And then Walker Percy was a good friend while he was at LSU for a while, but continued to be a good friend. So it's I'm the Robert Penn Warren professor emeritus. So those connections are very meaningful to me, and I have all their books and a number of them signed out in my library. My library is out in the back, not too far back, a real library fashioned out of a garage. And I call it Pleasure Dome from Kublai Khan's poem, or Coleridge's poem, Kublai Khan.
And you used to have most of those books on Park Boulevard.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm giving them away one day at a time. One each day. Well, not each day even, but I was out there today trying to select a few to turn loose of, but I go out there four or five times a day just to kind of mosey around, and it's really enjoyable. You know, I've got two huge bookcases full of books by my students and my friends. Well, more than two, I think it's four, which is about 1,000 or over 1,000 books, and that's good company these days. So, and I'm in pretty good health, and so is Robbie, and we go all over creation. We go to Raleigh, Greensboro, Charlotte, back and forth.
All right. We'll part company for just a moment and return with the incomparable David Madden. 877-217-5757. Now the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. And our guest for another segment is David Madden, the celebrated writer. 41 years he spent in Baton Rouge. He now lives in North Carolina with his beautiful wife, Roberta Madden. Many may remember Roberta. Robbie is the head of Common Cause in Louisiana back in the day. But David Madden was born July 25th, 1933. So tomorrow is birthday number 85 for this fine gentleman. And 1933 produced the birth of Ernest James Gaines on January 15th and Gus Weill on March 12th. A lot of good writers born in that year, David Madden.
Yeah, including Cormac McCarthy from my hometown, Knoxville, 1933. We had many parallels. We were in the Army in Alaska at the same time. I wanted to say that, well, there is one thing in honor, or two things in honor of Robert Penn Warren that I created when I was there. I created the Robert Penn Warren Seminar Room and the Robert Penn Warren Professorship. And I hope they're still going there. But a building that you mentioned before certainly ought to be something they'd seriously consider.
Well, Robert Penn Warren won the Pulitzer for All the King's Men, and that book has many quotes. But here's one from Willie Stark, who was, of course, the character based on Huey Long, about how he took care of his enemies. I fixed him so his unborn great-grandchild will wet their pants on this anniversary and not know why.
Yeah, that's good. You know, you have the major biographer of Huey Long right there in town. I viewed him, Professor White, in the Dick White,
yes,
in the business college. Have you interviewed him?
Oh, many times, many times. He wrote a fine book about Huey Long. It's hard to. It's
hard. I was his agent for that. I was his agent for that, by the way. Yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No. It's a little challenge following T. Harry Williams, but Richard White did an exceptional job with his book about Huey Long. Now, another listener, this is June at LSU, noting that this is the 40th anniversary of The Suicide's Wife, a book written by David Madden that was nominated for the Pulitzer, and some of us remember a movie starring Angie Dickinson.
Absolutely, yeah. She was so wonderful, and she's still beautiful, and anytime I mention her name, especially to men, their eyes light up. She is a fine person.
Yeah, well, you've had several books through the years that have been prominent, and it continues. You have not stopped writing, have you?
No, I'm about to send to my agent a memoir called My Creative Life in the Army. I just finished it and polishing a little bit today. And then I have about a 600-page memoir of my mother that's all ready for me to revise, and a collection of essays called The Activist in the Ivory Tower. That'll ring a bell for a lot of people who know me there in Baton Rouge, because it deals with the many controversies I got embroiled in. And then a novel called The Killing Dream, which I conceived 50 years ago.
You started the Civil War Center at LSU, and you, of course, believe that we should continue to remember what happened in the war of all wars for this country that tore our nation apart. But at the same time, last year, you became an avid proponent of tearing those monuments down in New Orleans. Some might think that was a bit of a disconnect, but you believe that they're certainly consistent to remember the Civil War, but yet at the same time not salute those who were fighting for the Confederates.
Absolutely, but tearing down is not quite what I'm for. I'm for removing them from public view to museums. One of the finest Confederate museums in the country is right there in New Orleans. And when I was director of the Civil War Center, I sent them some materials. I even put a lot of our money into restoring a portrait of Nathan Bedford Forrest, not out of respect and love for him, but because he was an interesting major figure. Robert E. Lee, when he was dying, they said, "Who was the greatest?" And he said, "A man I never met, Nathan Bedford Forrest." Somebody like that, we want to remember as part of the experience. Another person who took power in 1933 when I was born was Hitler, taking advantage of the democratic process of the Weimar Republic. That was the death knell of it. He was legitimately elected, and he took advantage of it to install his dictatorship. So I like feeling a part of history that took place when I was alive and not. But let me say I'm very proud of having created the Civil War Center. I'm very sad that it was destroyed for no good reason. But I want to mention that since I've come here, I've gotten involved in bringing attention to a very fine architect, Rafael Guastavino. Google him. It's incredible. He did 1,600 major buildings in New York, Washington, and throughout the country. And I'm building a museum to him here in Black Mountain, where he settled in his last years. So I'm still involved in what people in the English department used to say, that I'm colonizing the various rooms on the second floor of Allen Hall, as when I converted that nothing room, mail room, into Robert Penn Warren's seminar room.
Well,
so I'm involved in that and many other activities here, and Robbie is the main force behind getting the Equal Rights Amendment ratified, and we hope North Carolina will be the final one. We only need one.
She was active for many years, and many have wondered why such a beautiful, gracious lady stayed with you all those years, David Madden. What's
the
secret?
She has an answer that I think she, I don't even think she said it on your program, but I know that Jay Darden did, and I think you put him up to it. Do you happen to remember what it was?
I think it was that you've stayed together because you're both in love with the same man.
Well, you know, my reputation for modesty takes a hit every time somebody repeats that. You know, people don't understand that my egotism is just for play. You know, I really love to play around with the and make fun of myself. You know, making fun of myself, I'd make more fun of myself than I make fun of other people, you know, even some prominent people on the national scene, maybe, whose name I will not say because I don't want to promote that person.
All right. Well, David Madden retired in 2008 as Robert Penn Warren Professor of Creative Writing at LSU. And another listener mentions your past in the media. I think you, I'm sure of it. I know you've told me the story how you started in radio, and you wrote a book called On the Big Wind. That was a novel, kind of a hidden jewel.
Well, I appreciate your saying that because it I cobbled together a bunch of stories about that announcer. Well, he was more than an announcer. He began in Eastern Kentucky I began in Knoxville, but those are some of my best stories. I'm glad to say that I've had four collections of stories, not all of them called collections, and you talked with me last year about the latest, which was a collection of novellas, Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh, about my based on some of my experiences in the Merchant Marine and as a movie usher in Knoxville.
Well, it is always good to catch up with you, and hope you have a great birthday. And I'm sure there are many more to come. You're hale and hearty at almost 85 years young, David Madden.
Yeah, only a few more hours and I'll be 85.
Well,
thank you, Jim. It's really great talking with you. Anytime, please.
We'll be in touch. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Today, by the way, 24th day of July, 1964, Riverside, California, was the birthplace and birthday of the most prolific Major League Baseball home run hitter of all time, Barry Lamar Bonds, who hit 762 home runs for the Pirates and the Giants between 1986 and 2007. And it was on August 7th of 2007 that he broke Hank Aaron's record that had lasted for 33 years, 756 home runs at the time. And here's how it sounded with Dwayne Kuiper making the call. August 7, 2007, Barry Bonds.
And Bonds hits one high. Hits it deep. It is out of here. 756. Bonds stands alone. He is on top of the all-time home run list. What a special moment for Barry Bonds. And what a special moment for these fans here in San Francisco. There it is.
Barry Bonds, 762 career home runs, but he is not in the Baseball Hall of Fame because of his steroid use. Roger Clemens, who won 354 games, is also not in the Hall of Fame. They were the two best players of their generation and two of the best players in the history of the game, and they are not in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Gaylord Perry, who admitted cheating, in fact wrote a book called Me and the Spitter, is in the Hall of Fame. But Barry Bonds should not be forgotten. He was the most dominant player of his era after he hit 73 home runs in 2001 to set a record for most homers in a season. At the age of 40, he batted .362 with 45 home runs and 232 walks. We're back. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and our guest is Kate Davies. She is a professor at Antioch University, senior fellow at the Whidbey Institute, and clinical associate professor in the University of Washington School of Public Health. And she has a compelling book, Intrinsic Hope, Living Courageously in Troubled Times. Whether it's climate disruption, growing social inequality, pollution, our wild and woolly politics, we're living in an era of unprecedented crises resulting in what some might say are widespread feelings of fear, despair, and grief. And Intrinsic Hope is a book that addresses the powerful emotions we're experiencing in this uncertain world in which we live. And it is a pleasure to talk with you, Kate Davies.
Well, hello.
What are your thoughts about where we are now as a people in this country?
Well, I think that we are living in troubled times. You know, when I talk to my friends and colleagues, very few people seem to have a lot of hope about the future. People seem to be generally feeling pretty gloomy about what's happening and where we seem to be going. And no matter where you sit politically, I think a lot of people are feeling pretty down and hopeless about where we seem to be going. And I really wrote the book to address that kind of feeling and for people that feel that way.
You describe yourself as a hopeful survivor.
Yes, yes. I've spent most of my career working on environmental issues of various sorts. And over that time, you know, I got feeling pretty hopeless myself and pretty down myself as more and more scientific information has come out about the state of the environment. And so I got in a pretty hopeless state. And so this book really is the story of what I did to feel more hopeful and what I call a personal inquiry into hope that that led me to see that there is another way to be hopeful in these times. And so I do consider myself a hopeful survivor.
Well, when we see many of these measurements that you near and dear, and we'll talk about some of them, going in the wrong direction, how is it possible to retain hope?
Well, I think it all depends on what we mean by this word hope. And if you look it up in the dictionary, most dictionaries will define hope as using words like expectation and anticipation and desire. So in other words, hope is about expecting or anticipating specific improvements in life, that we expect things to get better. But these days, we don't know that things are going to get better for sure. We can't possibly know absolutely for sure. So in the dictionary, there's another definition of hope that doesn't depend on getting what we want, on getting our desires met, on the fact that we want life to conform to our wishes. And that's what I call intrinsic hope. It's really a hope that comes from deep within us that doesn't depend on external circumstances, but it's more of a trust or even a faith in life itself and in how life is unfolding, regardless of whether we like it or not and whether we like what's happening in the external world or not. It's kind of a basic trust in life itself, and because it comes from inside us, it's an orientation to life, an outlook on life. That's why I call it intrinsic hope.
You are a vegetarian, are you not, Kate?
I am indeed, yes.
And why?
I'm a vegetarian for a number of reasons. You know, probably the most important one is that one day I was driving on the highway and a truck drove past me with a lot of chickens in it, in the little cages that they get put in on the way to the slaughterhouse. And the chickens were, you know, really cramped in, and I could see them. I was passing the truck, and I just saw their suffering and the suffering that animals go through in order to become food on our table just really overwhelmed me. And so I did a bit of research into what happens to animals who are raised for food. And it's very clear to me that, you know, these are sentient beings. They feel pain. They feel suffering much as we do. And I just didn't want to be part of that system that inflicted so much pain on animals. And I understand that you know, other people feel differently, and that's fine. Secondly, second reason I'm a vegetarian is that scientists say that animal production, everything that goes into animal production, is really one of the primary sources of greenhouse gases that are being emitted to the atmosphere, and hence to climate change. You know, whether it's the animal's digestive processes, to be polite about it, or whether it's all of the grain that's grown to feed the animals. Animals raised for food are unquestionably one of the major sources of greenhouse gas emissions, and that troubles me deeply. If there's something simple that I can do not to contribute to that.
You state in the book that more than half of the world's greenhouse gas emissions are caused by animals raised for human consumption, and I don't think anybody in their right mind is denying that we're having climate change, but what is the reason for it, in your judgment?
I think it's a complex picture, you know, and I'm a scientist. My background is in environmental science and environmental policy, and I've looked at the scientific studies, and certainly climate change, it seems to me, is happening. It's real. And I would say that the vast majority of scientific evidence indicates that it is caused by human activities, whether you're looking at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change work or you're looking at work, the study that's pretty well known that looked at all of the kind of big reviews of climate change and concluded that about, I think it was 96 or 99% of scientists agree that climate change is real and is caused by human activities. You know, I respect people that think differently, but as someone with scientific training, I'm pretty convinced that that human beings are causing the majority of climate change that's happening. And I just see it, you know, see all the extreme weather events that are happening, the extreme heat that's happening right now across the U.S. Is unprecedented, and I think it is evidence that climate change is happening. And as I say, it seems to me that it's based on the scientific evidence that it's caused mostly by human activity.
Dr. Kate Davies' book is Intrinsic Hope: Living Courageously in Troubled Times. Another aspect of our world that you delve into is one that is probably going to be as big an issue as climate change, and that's water scarcity. How's that one going?
Yeah, so water scarcity is a big problem already, and I would predict that it's going to get worse, not only because of climate change, but also because we're using so much water now. In our cities and towns and for our industry and so on. And we see water shortages happening not only in this country already. You know, I'm on the West Coast, and there are huge water shortages and battles over water in California in particular. But we see it at a global level. You know, there's a large number of countries that are already living with what the United Nations calls severe water scarcity, and the predictions are that it's going to get a lot worse. And there are already, you know, there's already violence and wars being fought over water access to water resources. It's a big issue.
One of your messages that you take from Carl Jung is, "We cannot change anything unless we accept it."
Right. So what I mean by that is that if we deny or avoid what's happening, then we won't be able to deal with it effectively. Unless we accept the world that we're living in and the way things are, we won't be able to come up with effective actions to deal with our problems if we're constantly, you know, as I say, denying them or avoiding them. Now, acceptance is I think often confused with resignation, but I think there's a big difference between them. Resignation is when we kind of give up and throw in the towel, but acceptance says, yes, we've got a problem, and now we know we've got a problem, we can work on it. So it's like an alcoholic who, as long as they deny that they're an alcoholic, they're not likely to take effective action deal with it. But once they recognize they're an alcoholic, even if they don't like the fact that they're an alcoholic, then they're more likely to do something about it and work with the problem. So acceptance, I think, is really important here.
The book, Intrinsic Hope, from Dr. Kate Davies, and it has been a pleasure. Certainly it is a compelling read. Thank you, Dr. Davies.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. We'll start with Rick Edmonds, the state lawmaker who is running for Secretary of State. We heard from A.G. Crow a little earlier on the program today, and we'll, as I stated, hopefully hear from all the candidates seeking to succeed. Now, Kyle Ardoin, who's seeking to succeed himself. He took the job after Tom Shedler resigned. Listener Trey on Bluebonnet notes that 78 home runs have been hit into McCovey Cove in San Francisco AT&T Park since it opened in 2001, 18 years. 35 of those were hit by Barry Bonds, who only played there for 7 years. Happy birthday, Barry Bonds. Back tomorrow. Stay tuned.